the greatest technologists in the world that I know have all done some time as managers, right? They all have that skill set, but they're never too far away, like never too many years removed from being an IC themselves.
Hi, 0800 DevOps listeners. Today, I'm talking with Charity Majors, CTO and co-founder at Honeycomb, book author, speaker, and let me say, a person unselfishly sharing her views and lessons from both leadership and engineering perspective. Charity, I can't tell you how great it is to have you here, and welcome to the show.
I'm so glad we finally managed to connect. This has been a long time in the making.
Definitely. It took us some time to catch up. At the time we started talking, you just came back from reInvent 2022.
Yes, 2 months ago.
Yeah, just 2 months ago. So maybe can you share some quick thoughts on how was it there? And are there any topics and ideas that stood out this past year?
reInvent, it's gotten so huge. The last time I was there for the full thing was, I think, in 2017. And I thought it was massive then. And it's gotten like, I think we're like 35,000 people there. Jesus, bigger than the town I grew up in. I didn't actually go to most of the sessions. There were lines just like stretching all the way out the doorway. But I got to talk to a lot of people who were coming there to like talk about observability and about open telemetry. And one of my biggest takeaways was just how excited the world is about OTel, which makes sense. Like, it's overdue. Like, I remember saying like 5 or 6 years ago, man, why are we all so behind when it comes to logging and like emitting data? Like, why isn't there a standard for this? And now there is. Apparently, OTel is the second biggest project behind Kubernetes of the fucking consortium, open source. I always forget the four little group.
Cloud Native Computing Foundation.
Yeah, the CNCF. Thank you. Yeah, second biggest by number of contributions and activity, and I could not be more excited. We have a long way to go, but people are really leaning in, people are really adopting it, and then like it's picking up steam. So yeah, pretty excited about that.
Something to keep an eye on.
Definitely.
Before we dive deep into the topic, Charity, can you tell us a bit more about the context that you're coming from and your engineering and leadership background?
Sure. Actually, let me say one thing about OTel first, because I feel like I should tell people why they should be excited. The reason they should be excited is for the first time, the pitch is that you instrument your stuff once, and then you can use any vendor, more or less. But like, instead of like, so many people are just stuck because they have vendor lock-in, right? Like, who wants to go through all of the energy of ripping out and replacing an entire, you know, instrumentation throughout your entire stack? It's like the idea of ripping out all of your blood vessels. Like, this is just so embedded everywhere. And the idea of OTel is that instead of all the vendors having to like employ an army of people who write libraries and instrumentation for every single language and environment, instead you instrument your code once, and then just the configuration file, you can switch it from like New Relic to Honeycomb to Datadog or whatever, and which makes the vendors compete for your business, not based on lock-in, but based on their features and how well they do for you and like in terms of the user experience, which is exciting, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
All right. Back to your other question. My background. I was a classical piano major. I'm a music major. Dropout. I've been in San Francisco since I was 19. I've always been like an operations engineer, and then kind of became a databases engineer. But I've always, my sweet spot has always been like, I like to be the first infrastructure person that gets hired. When you've got like a team of software engineers and they've built something, they're starting to get some traction, they think they're going to have real users, and then they realize that everything that they did on the back end like is just shit, right? Like, so they need deployments, they need like automation, and they need all this stuff. And so that's where I like to come in. And I've been in management a couple times, gone back and forth. I was never one of those kids who was like, I'm gonna start a company, because I kind of low-key hate or despise the whole founder industrial complex. Everybody thinks they're so much better than everyone else. It's really annoying. But when I was coming out of Facebook, there were some investors who were like, like for the first time I had a pedigree, right? And so people are like pushing some money at me, and I felt like an obligation on behalf of all queer people and women and dropouts everywhere to take the money and do something with it. And to my surprise, we're still going strong. Really never expected that. But here we are, Honeycomb. Just our on January 1st, we had our 7-year anniversary. We started 7 years ago, and it's still up and to the right. So good times.
Cool. Congratulations for the anniversary.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you mentioned recently that your post about engineering management pendulum is your most read post ever. And now I know why is it called pendulum, piano, metronomes, and things like that.
I never connected those. Yeah, you're right.
I wrote that post
for a friend of mine who was, he was a director at Slack at the time. And he was really like, Slack was like in its takeoff stage. And he was really struggling with, you know, he wasn't happy. He was miserable. He wanted to go back to being an IC, but there's this feeling you get, like you've accumulated so much knowledge and influence. Like, are you throwing it all away if you just go back to being an engineer? And so he was really struggling with that. And I wrote this post to try and convince him that he would have just as much influence and just as much fun. And he wouldn't be like losing anything if he went back to being an engineer. He went back to being a principal engineer. And a year later, he was the happiest I've ever seen him. So it really just redoubled my faith in that this is the way. You honestly, as a technologist, the greatest technologists in the world that I know have all done some time as managers, right? They all have that skill set, but they're never too far away, like never too many years removed from being an IC themselves, because there's wisdom that you get from dealing with the technology that you can't get from sitting, you know, several layers away from the technology. And so, you know, I really think that we should value that in and of itself, that handiness with both skill sets, not just one or the other.
Yeah, yeah. That's a super cool approach. And we see that senior engineers moving into this leadership related roles have questions. Their life mostly looks terrible in the beginning. They don't know, should they still code or should they just leave everything and start managing, whatever that means. So how do you see this transition from IC to engineering management? Where do you see the most friction happening in this process?
I don't know if friction is the right term for it, but it's definitely, you have to become a different person in a way in order to, like, you go through a process that takes a year or two at least, through which your reactions change, the things that you value change, the things that you look for to know if what you're doing has value or not changes, your rhythms change, the way that you pace yourself throughout the day changes, the kind of energy that you use changes, you know, and when you go back to be an engineer, you have to go through that process again in reverse, right? And once you've gone back and forth a couple of times, I think it gets easier. But the first time, it's people generally aren't prepared for just how different it's going to be and how it's like, you know, if you're, you know, say you're in college or whatever, and then you're suddenly kind of back in fourth grade in some ways, because everything seems hard again and it's a struggle just to get through the day. And the most unsettling thing is that you're used to knowing if you did a good job or not. So you can go home at the end of the day, go like, I fixed it, I built it, I landed my diff, I deployed my shit, and you get this sense of like relief and just like satisfaction and pride in yourself. And you don't get that as a manager for a very long time. You don't know if what you're doing is good or bad. The things that you do and put out into the world don't really seem to connect to anything, any of the consequences that come back at you, because you're dealing with consequences from everybody else's actions. And because the consequences of your actions aren't usually going to bear fruit for a week, a month, a year, five years. Right. And so just the process of learning when and how to feel good about yourself is, I think, the hardest part, because it's very individual. It's very unique. No one can tell you how to do it. All they can do is prepare you for the process, that it's going to be difficult and that you should expect it. You shouldn't just feel bad about yourself because you don't feel good about yourself, if that makes any sense, because you're not going to feel good about yourself, because you shouldn't, because you don't know what you're doing.
Definitely. I mean, this feedback loop is very long, which doesn't help the process. And I personally had situations where team leads, after moving to individual from individual contributor role, would tell me that they don't feel like they're bringing value to the table anymore. So how do you help people in such situations? So this is precisely what you are talking about right now.
Yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, you get kind of hooked as an engineer on just the dopamine drug of like shipping things and building things and fixing things, right? And you're never going to get that as a manager. Where was I going with that? What was your question?
Yeah, the question is, how do you help people when they feel like they're not bringing any value to the
table? Right. I was like, management often feels useless. It often feels completely superfluous. And because it is, I mean, honestly, you can sit there as a manager just doing your job and, you know, maybe a little stress from time to time, but you can sit there and go, I have added no value to this team over the past 2 months, when the team is in a good spot, right? But then something's going to happen where the team is not in a good spot. And that's where it's going to become very obvious whether or not you've built up trust during those periods of time, right? Whether people trust you, whether they feel emotionally safe, whether they will come to you or not, right? But like, you can't predict when those times are going to be. When a team is working right, yeah, it feels like managers do absolutely nothing, because they kind of do. Yeah. No team is working well all the time forever, right? And part of being a manager is just like, you know, doing the job, right? Day in, day out, being predictable, being reliable, proving to people over and over again that you can be trusted, that they can come to you. And then being ready in those moments to make hard decisions, to know who your network is, to know how you get advice, right? Because mm-hmm. as a manager, you can't make decisions in a vacuum the way you kind of could as an engineer. There's no such thing as a good decision independent of other people, because all the decisions involve other people. So like, who is your network? That's going to play into whether or not you're a good manager. So that's how I think about it. It's fine if you feel useless from time to time. And you kind of have to just have a sense of humor about it and be like, this is the way it is. It's not that you have no value, but it's a really bad sign if a manager feels needed every day, because that means the team is in crisis every day. And that's not what you want to have happen.
Yeah, you have a point there. I mean, new engineering managers usually have questions along the lines of, should I now just stop coding? And one advice that you are giving to engineering managers is one of your recent talks. I saw, don't stop writing code completely, but also don't put yourself in critical paths.
Yeah.
So this seems
I think new managers get a lot of very well-intentioned advice to stop coding, to just like completely stop doing or thinking anything technical. And that's an overreaction. But I understand why people give them that advice, because that's your happy place. That's where you feel confident and comfortable, where you know you can make a difference. And so when you get stressed, you want to retreat to your happy place until you feel good about yourself again. And you really have to break yourself of that habit, right? But I don't think it's good for engineer managers to just stop being technical, because you'll be a weaker engineering leader if you don't stay up on things. And the key is exactly what you just said, right? Don't put yourself in the critical path. Don't put yourself in a position where anyone on the team is waiting on you to land a diff, right? Or when any of your code is going out in a really critical deploy, right? There's plenty of work to be done around the edges, right? To like scratch the itch, to keep your hand in practice, that doesn't, you know, put you in that position. Because ultimately, you know, it used to be that your job was the code and the product and the project. Now your job is the people, and you have to, if you have to drop the work that you're doing with people to go attend to code, you're really doing it wrong.
Yeah, you are leaving your product aside.
Exactly.
And this naturally draws another somewhat controversial question of non-technical people leading engineers. So non-technical people in the role of engineering management. What did you see out there talking to people? I know it heavily depends on particular people and we shouldn't be generalizing, but how well does it work when non-technical people lead technical teams?
There are exceptional truly exceptional non-technical people out there doing good jobs leading engineering teams, but they are very much the exception. Now, engineers often will say things like, the best manager I ever had didn't know how to write any code. You know, the happiest team I was on, you know, was one where, you know, we had a non-technical manager. And this is where I think you can't confuse, I was happy because nobody was telling me what to do, with the outcomes were great. Right. I think that a lot of times engineers would love it if their managers knew nothing about what they were doing and had no opinions and wouldn't guide them at all. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's best for the team or the company. In general, I think that you really want engineering managers to be technical, because it's your job to guide the team, to help develop your people, to help ensure the quality of the product. And how can you do that if you can't look at a diff and understand whether it's good or not? You can't be the arbiter between, you know, when you have two engineers who are on very different pages about, you know, what the style should be or what the, you know, the process should be. How can you hope to weigh in and resolve this conflict? You can't. You can only be a paper pusher, right? And a lot of it comes down to respect too. The way you gain the respect of your engineering team is when they can see that you know what you're talking about because you've been through the trenches. I just, across the board, I think that technical managers have better outcomes than non-technical managers.
Yeah. Yeah.
The non-technical managers who are successful tends to be a pattern where you have to pair one tightly with a tech lead. So you're basically splitting the management function in two. You're saying, okay, we're going to have people manager do the people stuff. And, you know, the technical lead will do all the technical stuff. And this is a kludge. It can work. I think it's inferior because what you find is the people manager is still the one who's, you know, doing the promotions and everything, and they have to outsource all of their opinions and decision-making and have complete trust in their tech lead, right? Yeah. And tech lead's got, you know, agendas and missions of their own. It's a lot better when that's in one person.
Yeah, yeah. Fully agree.
The same as saying that the engineering manager needs to be the most senior engineer on the team, because that is not the case. I think engineering managers can absolutely manage teams with engineers who are way senior to them and you know, way better engineers than them. But they do have to have some judgment of their own that they can rely on.
Yeah, definitely. We had this notion years ago that exactly that team lead engineering manager in the team should be the strongest technical person in the team. But we soon realized it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it cannot be done. And if you want your people in the team to grow, then you shouldn't even strive to be the best technical person in the
team. You want your best engineers to be engineering, if that's what makes them happy.
Yeah. And it nicely summarizes what you also said in one of your talks. Don't self-identify as a manager or as an engineer. So look at your career as a technical leader who needs both these sets of skills to reach their full potential. And this is precisely what happens when you have one person with both set of skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely a better option if you can actually choose how to staff your engineering management team.
Yeah, and in my experience, this comes naturally to engineers. You know, engineers don't typically go, I'm done with coding forever. I want to be a manager and just like, you know, they want to try things. They want to go back and forth. It's just that most organizations haven't figured out how to incentivize this or how to support people in doing it. You kind of have to like, you have to go against the grain. You have to like put, you know, because like I've heard from so many engineering managers who are like, I really wanted to go back to being an IC, but my director was like, what, and waste all of my investment in you? Or like, but we've built you up here, you know, and you know, you're just going to throw that all away. And I think that is such a short-sighted way of thinking of it. Like, if you want to be optimizing, not for people becoming more powerful in one role, you want to be optimizing for them staying curious and engaged. You want to optimize for retaining them, right? If they go back to being an IC and maybe they come back to being a director or not, they're going to be so much more powerful in your organization. And this is where I feel like organizations need to figure out how to give really senior ICs actual leadership opportunities, like actual decision-making opportunities, not just consulting. The manager shouldn't be there sitting there making all of the technical decisions, right? They should be facilitating an environment where, you know, the very strong principal and staff and senior engineers are making that and owning the technical decisions, which is a harder thing to do, but it's what actually makes engineers happy. And it's what actually keeps them there, like retained and stimulated and engaged in the product longer on. You know, so many people will hop jobs from like every year or two or three. If you're building the kind of company where you want to retain engineers for 5, 6, 7 years, you have to expect them to change jobs every 18 to 24 months, let's say. And you just have to bake that into the process. I think that something that Facebook did that was amazing that I think more companies should steal is the notion that you have to. You can't stay in the same engineering role for 3, 4, 5 years. That creates little backwaters where things are done differently than the rest of the company. And it creates single points of failure. And it has all of these, you know, terrible second, third order effects. Instead, be like, okay, you've been in this role at this team for two years. Time to start looking around the company for your next one, right? It keeps people circulating. It keeps, you know, it keeps standards and practices being, you know, standardized. And it makes sure that people are moving around continually, improving their skills, you know, trying new things. And it's like blood, right? You want the circulatory system to be constantly like moving things around and keeping things fresh.
It kind of reminded me on a heating system and how periodically you want to turn on all of your valves and then turn them off. So just make them move, because otherwise if they get stuck, then you are in a problem. So
exactly. Yes. The worst time to make changes is when you're already in a crisis. The good time to make changes is just like, you know, cosmically, practically, like over time.
You don't want to test your valves when you have
fire.
Leakage and fire in
exactly.
But much of what you said, I feel like it is actually the effect of organizations treating management as a promotion. And yes. I know you have a very clear opinion on this.
Yeah. Management is not a promotion. It's a change of skills. In fact, if you're going from being an engineer to being a manager, you're regressing in terms of your skill. You're not going to be a great manager for a long time, right? And I feel like that's great. That's fine. Like, we need to invest in people. We should give people the room to be bad at things and grow. But if you create management as a promotion, then what happens when somebody wants to go back to being an engineer? You're demoting them?
Yeah.
Come on. People can't, nobody can tolerate that. That's just not compatible with human psyches, right? You don't want people to feel like being an engineer is a demotion. And so management can't be a promotion.
Yeah. What are some practical things that organizations should keep in mind to level the field between management and...
Well, I think salaries are an important thing to look at. You know, if people see the, you know, you can yap all you want about engineers and management being, you know, equals, but if you see management getting paid a lot more, they're going to know you're lying.
There is a difference, obviously.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you have to bake into your processes and your ladders, like look at them from the perspective of someone who's going back and forth. Like, does it make sense from that perspective? Or because you can't treat it like a one-off every time, right? I also think it's super important to remember that management is just a bunch of skills, right? And people don't have to become managers in order to learn those skills. I think that you should ask every engineer, you know, at least once a year or so, what they see as their future as being like. You know, do you want to try management someday? Management shouldn't be something like, you know, the God from on high comes and taps someone, is like, you have been blessed with the opportunity. And everybody else is like, well, we didn't know, you know, like that's destabilizing. It's more like everyone should know, okay, you know, these three people over here would like to try management someday. So let's help them start learning the skills, right? Like, maybe they can start, you know, running some meetings, or, you know, being the lead on a project, or maybe one of them can build the intern program, or one of them can have an intern. You know, there are all of these things that they can do to start trying out management skills that'll tell them if they actually enjoy the work or not, right? Much better than just the job description will. And And then when an opening comes up, I also think you always need to look internally before you hire externally. See if there's anyone internally who wants the job. Pick the person who seems like best poised to be successful. And then let them try it. I think you want to ask people to commit to at least a year, year and a half, ideally 2 years as a manager, because it takes that long to even figure out if you like it or not, or if you're any good at it or not. Like most people who become managers would quit in the first few months otherwise. but I really feel like it should be much more of a predictable process, and it's just kind of a no big deal. Yeah, it's just a different role. You know, you'll try it for a while. If you don't like it, you can go back. We encourage you to listen to your heart and what really satisfies you and what really brings you joy. I don't know what else to say about it. I feel like taking the magic and the mystery and the really hierarchical, like, it's not your job as a manager to give orders. In fact, every time you lean on your formal powers as a manager, you're depleting them in some way, right? Once in a while, maybe once or twice a year, you could be like, because I said so, but you don't get to play that card very often, you know, or people are not going to want to leave your team. I also feel like, rotating people around the company is really good. I feel like people should have some agency in what team they want to go to and what team they want to join. Right now, obviously, like, not all parts of the company have needs at all times, but, like, you know, if like there are these 3 or 4 teams that all have the need, then letting someone choose who they want to go work with is a pretty strong signal about how the managers are viewed by their contemporaries and who really wants to work with them.
With you, yeah.
I think that there are some people who want to be managers who really aren't good at the job, and if they can't be trained into doing better, they should probably be gently, like, eased out of it. But you don't know until you try. So I'm just a big fan of, like, making it so that anyone who really wants to be a manager gets a chance to try out management skills.
Yeah. And I love what you said about these time spans. So if you're trying with something like management roles, please do try it at least a year or two or some longer period of time to figure out the gist of it. And I think it's important to talk about these time frames, especially also in terms of moving from individual contributor role to engineering management role. So getting better in engineering up to the point that you can start taking over some management responsibilities takes some time. And yeah. This is sometimes difficult to accept for young generations in these days of instant gratification and things moving super forward, super fast.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this? In your experience, how long are these time spans? When should one start thinking about trying the engineering management role?
Not until you're solidly a senior engineer. And not in a title inflation sort of way, but I mean like 7 or 8 years of engineering.
Yeah.
You have to accept that, you know, the level of engineer that you're at when you become a manager you're not going to go up anymore. You know, as a manager, it's only going to slowly decrease, and you have to be okay with that. You also, like, if you've only been an engineer for like 4 or 5 years, your knowledge is going to really, really rapidly decay. And after a year or two, you're going to find it really hard to go back. I think that 7 or 8 years is about when you become what I think of as solidly a senior engineer, right? You know, you've gone broad, hopefully you've gone deep a bit, you've been in a couple of different teams, you have some, you know, experience, some knowledge. That's about when I think it's appropriate for you to, because it is a leadership role, right? Management is not the only kind of leadership, and it's not synonymous with leadership, but it is absolutely a leadership role. And so it's one where, you know, you want people to have some experience.
Yeah. It reminds me on a quote by Kelsey Hightower. It was one of his interviews, and I have this quote pretty close because it resonates so much. He said, "There is no substitute for experience. It just takes time. You cannot read about something by doing it. You nothing substitutes doing it, actually."
Yeah.
And when you say 7 or 8 years, it could sound a lot of time to somebody who is in a junior position, but it's actually very realistic. Yeah. And it goes so fast. It flies by.
Yeah.
Definitely. Charity, let's shift gears a bit and talk about another highly popular topic these days, and that's platform engineering. I think you will also agree that it is a hot topic these days. There has been many hot takes about platform engineering, almost to the point of platform engineering being a silver bullet, basically, for everything. Yeah. How do you look at it, especially at the statements like DevOps is dead and platform engineering will replace DevOps and so on?
Yeah, well, as you must know, that really set me off, and I ended up writing a very long piece in rebuttal of it. It's such bullshit. Oh my God, I hate these hot takes. In some ways, I do think that platform engineering is a bit of a successor to the DevOps movement, just like it's kind of a successor to like software engineering. It's a form of operationally focused software engineering, where your customers are internal instead of external, right? It's, you know, you build a platform. The platform engineering is the layer of engineering that sits between your vendors, whether it's AWS or Azure or, you know, whatever, and your engineers internally. And their job is to create consistency, to create, you know, ease of use. Your job is to make sure that the easiest thing to do is also the right thing to do, and that the, you know, the hard things to do are the wrong things to do. One of the things that I said in my piece was that, you know, software engineers, you know, are supposed to look for external measurements, like, you know, how many users are using it, how many errors there are, you know, the user experience and everything. And for platform engineering, the right measure of their success is actually developer experience. How quickly can the developers move? Platform engineering is not about owning software. It's not about being on call for all the software. It's not about being paged and escalating. It's about enabling your software engineers to own their own software, so that, you know, you give them the observability tools, you give them the paging, you know, rules, you give them, you know, the ability to spin up a service and deploy their own artifacts, right? You give them all these tools so that they can own their own code in production, not so that you can own it for them. That's the big difference between previous like DevOps models, where the DevOps model was much more, you know, okay, ops would like build stuff to help developers, but then developers would build the systems and ops would generally be on call for them. Like, instead, you know, this is a team that writes some software, pretty little software. I think one of the big goals of a platform engineering is to write as little software as possible, because it's mostly glue, but it can be very high impact software, like a few lines, you know, that power the world, because it hooks together, you know, some pretty powerful components. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these are some of the basic characteristics of a good platform. So being a glue, connecting things. One of the things that's always on top of my head is that actually platform is by definition a custom thing for the organization. Yeah. And it's also a question, what are your thoughts on those off-the-shelf platforms? So how viable is it for these generic platforms to solve problems of a particular organization with its own specific context?
I caveat that I have not used any of them. My confidence in them is quite low. This is exactly what the reason you said, like the point of a platform engineering team is to be very thin, and it's very custom, it's very bespoke. Kind of by definition, if you can buy it off the shelf, it isn't a platform.
yeah obviously building platform is a tricky business, especially in terms exactly what you said of keeping the balance between standardization on one hand and flexibility on the other.
Junior engineers. It's barely a job for senior engineers.
Yeah, definitely. In traditional organization, and you said that you have a system administration background, and in traditional organization, there has always been a place for sysadmins and people that generally took care of infrastructure and operations. And with this new infrastructure complexity, their job description is obviously changing now. So in which direction do you see the traditional sysadmins will move?
Well, I don't know any traditional sysadmins anymore. They've all become, you know, a sysadmin to me is someone who doesn't write code. And an engineer to me is someone who does write code. And all the sysadmins that I grew up with are now, you know, engineers, software engineers or DevOps engineers or platform engineers or something. And I mean, I think that's the future. You have to be able to, you have to be able to write code in order to, you know, deal with modern systems. That doesn't mean that you have to write a lot of code or that writing code needs to be what you do all day, but you do have to be able to write code. You can't just run software.
Yeah, yeah. It's like what Jackie Stewart, that famous Formula One driver, once said, you don't need to be an engineer to be a racing driver, but you do need to have a mechanical sympathy for the system. And
back to the quote that you used earlier about how there's no substitute for experience. I find that the experience of running software is one that is kind of consistently devalued and marginalized when it comes to software engineering teams. They typically don't give enough respect to just how difficult and how traumatic it can be. And you know, there's a sense you get from having run big system, big complex systems for a long time. You just you can sense where the holes are. You can sense what's a terrible thing to do. You know not to do certain things. And software engineers will just go merrily on down, and you're just like, ah. So I identify as an ops engineer, and I feel like most teams would benefit from a lot more ops experience than they currently have.
I really think so too. Charity, who are the people that you are following and things that you are reading these days that make you think and do better every day?
Oh, you know, I love Jess Citron. She's just amazing. I actually haven't been, I'm barely on Twitter these days. I try and pop on once a month or so. I've been reading a lot more non-technical stuff lately, honestly. But you know, I love Jess's stuff. I feel so sad about Twitter right now. So many people that I used to follow on Twitter aren't there.
It really is sad. Yeah.
So it's really a shame. You know, I really like, Gurley's, newsletter. He's like, I think I called him, the Gonzo journalist of tech or something. And he really is just, he's really like carrying the flame in a lot of great ways. There's a lot of great stuff out there. Dip your toe in when, also I want to give a plug out for this book by Sarah Drasner. It is the best, probably the only engineering.
You mean this one?
That one. Love it. Cheers. Bye. It's great. It's really, really, really good.
Yeah, it is. It's a great book.
I wasn't expecting a lot because I don't think much of most management books, but this one was really exceptional.
Charity, thank you for this conversation. Your thoughts on engineering management are priceless, and your comments are priceless. And thank you also for keeping the sanity in this platform engineering world.
Thanks for being so patient. I'm so glad we managed to connect.